Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Alexis Boylan. Alexis is an associate professor of art and art history and women's, gender, and sexuality studies, and is the associate director of the Humanities Institute at the University of Connecticut. Her research focus is on the visual culture of the United States from the colonial to the contemporary periods, with a particular emphasis on race and gender. In this episode, I caught up with Alexis at the Bryn Mawr Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alexis is an alum of Bryn Mawr and volunteers with other alumni to operate one of the few remaining used bookstores in the Boston area. Since its founding in 1971, the Bryn Mawr Bookstore has used the profits from its sale of fine, used, and rare books to fund scholarships to Bryn Mawr College for students from New England. We've partnered with the bookstore to share stories of its alumni, volunteers, and patrons. This is the first episode in that ongoing series. Before we sat down, Alexis gave me a tour of the bookstore and explained an interesting decorative element. Well, maybe before we talk about, like, you as a reader, I just want to note my favorite thing about this space. I'm going to take a picture of it, and that's the artworks you have on the walls.
So,
what's going on with this twig from hanging from the ceiling?
I don't know that.
Or branch. Maybe it's unfair for me to say twig.
Yeah, no, I think you can really call it whatever you want. No one...
To me, that actually sums up the Bryn Mawr Bookstore, because no one can kind of... no one has any idea who put it up. No one has any idea why it's there. I think I said this to you earlier, but if someone, I guarantee if someone took it down, like at least four volunteers would be like, there'd be like a really nasty letter. They would resign. We'd have to have a meeting. We'd have to maybe have a mediation about it. A lot of feelings would be had. And then eventually it would go back up again. So
like, circle life.
Yeah. So like to me, like the both like, that no one really knows what it means. It doesn't really serve a purpose. It's not even aesthetically charming. Like, it really is, it's not even like an interesting twig. It's literally just like something that fell from the sky. And
wow. And there it is. And it's propped up really well. So even to get it down would really be difficult.
And then all the letters you'd have to write, and, you know.
I might have to write one of those letters.
No, I mean,
I'm really attached to it.
Yeah. So I feel like everybody looks at it and is like,
that should come down. But everybody knows better. You know, like no one wants to be that person. So, you know, it lives.
I love it. If you want to see this lovely twig, check out our website to see a photo. As you can gather from this introductory piece, Alexis is super sharp and super fun, and I really enjoyed our conversation. I really loved my time at the Bryn Mawr Bookstore, and I look forward to sharing the stories I heard there with you.
Now, do you have questions that you ask everybody?
Sort of. I mean, I usually start out by saying, you know, what are your earliest memories of reading?
Okay.
So,
okay.
What are you thinking?
I think that my earliest memories of reading are actually not me reading, so maybe this is like a total annoying, like, what is the technicality of the question that you were asking? My first memories are actually of my dad reading to me, and my dad was like a pretty sort of like serious guy, but not like scary serious, but just like a serious guy. But when he would read stories, he would have the craziest voices, like insane crazy voices. And every character had crazy voices. And I had a book that was actually of these two birds, and they were singing opera to each other. And my dad would do this crazy singing opera with these two crazy birds. Like,
was he a singer?
No, he was a terrible singer. But I just remember he would get so... reading these stories was just like laughing the whole time, like the both of us laughing the whole time. So I feel like my earliest memory of reading is actually just like it being like crazy joyful. Like that's what books, like that's what it meant to sit down and read, was to just laugh like really hard and be really goofy and then go to bed, which I guess maybe then I didn't actually go to bed right away. Like, because I was sort of thinking, I think that now as an adult, I'm like, got me pretty riled up. Like, it's like a really bad policy for like a 3-year-old to like have them be like, you know, like laughing and crazy.
Yeah.
But so I guess that's like maybe my earliest memory. In terms of my own reading, I was a serious Beverly Cleary person, like, and Ramona, of course, being the like the very popular ones. But I am often the person who goes like deep catalog, like,
yep.
So once I was like, oh, and I'm also a little bit of a contrarian, and even at like 8, I was, so I was like, everybody's into these Ramona books. That's not my scene. And I would like find the like earlier books, like her, you know, weird characters that didn't really come together. And then was very like, these are my favorite ones. Like, you guys just don't even know, like with your Ramona.
How did that play out with you?
That's actually that's the story of my entire life. That's like, you know, that I just refuse to, you know, like the, no, that's not, I mean, that did play out in my high school reading, which is that I would get obsessed with one thing and then just like I went through a probably deeply typical, although now as a feminist, like a deeply regrettable like obsession with Ernest Hemingway. And so like read it all. Like if he wrote it.
What brought that on, do you think?
I know exactly what brought it on. I read A Movable Feast, which is like, I really actually recently reread it, and I was like, this is even worse. Like, I need to go back and just help my former self to not, because it's just super misogynistic and everybody actually behaves so badly. Like, it's terrible. But that was like, 13-year-old me was like, that's the most sophisticated thing. Like, that's like, it was all very sophisticated. Like, and that's what I wanted, like, the most in my life, was to, like, travel around with, like, amazing, talented people and, like, amazing places and apparently be treated poorly by everyone and then, like, you know,
exactly.
Stiff people for bills and, you know, treat people who work like they're garbage and be racist. That,
never use adjectives,
no,
that kind of thing.
No, it's talking, like, staccato bursts, but...
But what, did you ever go through, like, so that was, like, 13, but before then, you know, there's all these, like, series that girls typically
read.
Oh,
man.
But if you're
so
a contrarian,
no,
did you go
so
for that?
So much Laura Ingalls Wilder. Like,
oh, man.
So deep, so hard. One of my favorite objects that I owned was actually a bonnet. Like, my mom at some point bought me, like, a crazy bonnet. And I just wore that bonnet and all my dolls, and we got in our like caravan, which was my bed, and we just had to go out west. We were always going. We never got anywhere. Like,
it's the climb.
It's, yeah, no, and it's this beautiful thing about those stories is that you're like, the stories slow down so much when it's like, only when Pa is unhappy or Pa loses everything, I'm like, great, fantastic. Where are they going now? Because like, when Pa settles down and they go to school, I'm like, I know this story. I go to school. I don't need this. Like, but yeah. So I mean, I read those books crazy. I did love. I mean, it's funny. Like, I also, there was like those skating books. I have no idea what it was, like skating slippers, ballet slippers.
Yeah.
So I must have that. I mean, I know that there are lots of series, but I felt like that was like a real thing when I was like an early reader.
Did you skate or dance or any of that kind of stuff?
No, none of the things that I do had. I don't actually like to be outside. That's actually probably a crucial piece of information about my Laura Ingalls Wilder.
So you were living it, but not outside.
No. Outside is where there were mosquitoes and bugs and like sunlight and it was sweaty and
because
gross.
Because there are memoirs of people who love Laura Ingalls who have gone and actually lived. Lived that story.
Except for the part where she makes the maple syrup in the snow, which like is literally is like crystal clear to me, like as if I just like read it a minute ago. But other than that, nothing. No reading isn't. So it was more just about going places. So it was about sort of like conceptualizing someplace else. But it wasn't really like then I was like, I'd love to be outside or. You know, I should, yeah.
Was it a way to kind of imagine a life that you wanted when you were older, or?
Not so much with the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, but definitely in my teenage years, I read as like a, like, went through a huge, like, Somerset Maugham phase, and I read all of his stuff. Like, just like a lot of sort of, like, well. I should also interject that I went through a very big, in between Laura Ingalls Wilder and Ernest Hemingway, sort of like preteen, teen year stuff, I went through a very dark Anne Frank phase, wherein like I read everything about Anne Frank, and then I read everything about the Holocaust. And then my mom started to get worried about it, as like an attentive parent would. And so then I wasn't allowed to have any Holocaust, because that was all I was, like, we would go at our school, this was in about fifth, sixth grade, so like when you read it, and, you know, and so we were allowed to bring three books home from the library. And about like the seventh week, I brought home exclusively Holocaust-oriented books. My mom was like, no Holocaust books, which just simply meant that I had to hide my Holocaust books under the bed. Like,
why do you think you were so into Holocaust books and Anne Frank?
Because I became a little convinced. So my grandmother had lived in Europe before World War II, and when World War II broke out, and she, her husband was Czech, and he was actually. He was worked for the resistance in Czechoslovakia, and was just sort of a nationalist against German aggression, and he was killed in a concentration camp. But that wasn't my grandfather. That was my grandmother was married before. She was in Prague for a while, and then she was in Vienna, and then actually she left Vienna and went back down to, like, the day that Vienna was, when the Nazis came through Vienna, she left Vienna, and because she had sort of wanted to stay put in Vienna, because she had thought that the Austrians would actually fight more, because she had been talking, like, they were all like, no, you know, Austria is its own country, and then they were like, welcome, and it was just like really traumatic. Like, she was like, oh, people are horrible, oh, that's like, I get that now, that, you know. So then she went down to Prague, and then she left Prague, and then she went to Paris, and then she had to leave Paris, and then she went to London, and she had her two kids at that point. And then she got out on one, she was an American citizen, she was just like, she was living in Europe, she was married to a European, like, you know, all of, like, she was European. There's in London, then she after, like, I guess the second or third night of one of the blitzes, the American consulate was like, you either have to like, we're doing the last, like, taking people with children home, like, you either have to, like, stay in England and good luck to you, or you have to come back to the States. So, and she often talked about Europe and about those experiences and that sort of thing. And so I think a little bit, like, I just sort of, like, my little brain just sort of, that felt very present. Like, it felt very, like, possible. Like, that felt very, and then when she came to the States, she my grandfather was Jewish, so then there was also this part that was like this sort of, like, you know, I would have been understood as a Jew, and, like, so there just, it was like a lot of sort of like, what is your identity and who are you, and, like, sort of me working through a lot of that. But
yeah,
and then I also, and this I think is very much kids reading, I very much became sort of obsessed with, like, secret hiding places, like where would I hide, where would I take my family, like, my mom and dad were just, like, so stupid they couldn't see the writing on the wall, but, like, so, like, I wasn't gonna be able to help them, like, when the Nazis came, but I could maybe help my brother, like, he was small, he listened to me more than my parents did, you know, like, he understood that this was real, like, we needed to think about this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did some very serious planning, some very, like, you know.
Wow.
And I actually got in trouble because I started stockpiling food, but I didn't really understand 100%, like, you know, how food ages.
Uh-oh.
So I got into a little trouble with that.
Did you hide it in your hiding place?
I hid it in my brother's closet.
Smart.
So he initially got in trouble, and then he was like,
he's not a snitch, so he was just like, I don't know how all that milk got there. But my mom, I think, was like, does this have anything to do with the totally forbidden Holocaust books that you continue to bring home from school? So we had to have a big talk about how probably, you know, the Nazis were not going to be coming anytime soon, and that Bethlehem, Pennsylvania was likely not to be, like, a first stop location. So, like, and that she promised that she would, like, keep up with the news and, like, just, you know. I mean, it didn't make me feel, I mean.
Like, how long did it take you to kind of, like, how old were you when this was happening, and when did you kind of come out of it?
Probably in the fifth and sixth grade. And it's funny, I think it was also just like a super distraction. My parents got separated at that point, and my mm-hmm. grandmother had actually moved down to live with us at that point. So I was actually just like hearing a lot of, so it was like a sort of like a lot of disruption in the family. But my parents were like super groovy, so like it was like disruptive, but we all talked about it. So like it wasn't disrupt, like it like nothing. It was, like, never an argument, and, you know, like, and if anything, I saw both my parents, like, more all of a sudden. Like, they became, like, really, like, you know, like, we're getting a divorce, so here we are. So I think that, you know, which, so it was a disruptiveness that was sort of, like, I think I sort of felt, what was interesting is I think that I was looking for something that was like extreme and demonstrative and like clear, like being locked in a room with your family because people are trying to kill you. Like that felt like concrete, and like I could put my arms around what that felt like and what that meant, and like exactly like sort of feelings of loss or sacrifice. But what I was experiencing had some of those feelings, but then like, what was there really to complain about? Like, there's mom, there's dad, like, live in the same house, go to the same, like, you know, so it was just, it was sort of a little bit, I think, in retrospect, like, that I sort of, I found some affection for this idea of, like, a circumstance that was outside of your control, but that was so clear to everyone around you, like, that the stakes were clear and high and sort of epic. And I stayed very attentive to, I still like epic tales. Like, I still find, like, I like big stories. I like big personalities. I like, you know, and I mean, if you feel like Anne Frank was, like, you know, like, if she grew up to be an adult, like, she wouldn't be, like, a small, quiet person. Like, she was just a very, like, there's just so much in that. And I was also, like, It was this sort of idea of somebody being that articulate and that present, and I wasn't when I was that age also. Mm. I think I was much more sort of internal in terms of what was going on. So it was interesting to see this person who, or read about this person who just had such command over language and even herself in a way that, you know, like, she would talk about, like, fighting with her parents, and that always just felt really, like, God, like
I always remember she was always like thinking very self-consciously about being a teenager. Mm-hmm. And there's really not that many books that feel like, when I was that age anyway, that were like true accounts of being a teenager, never mind the crazy circumstance of it. But
well, and it's weird because I think simultaneous a lot of my friends were into those Judy Blume books. They never spoke to me. I was like, I don't need to read a book about, like, a girl from a suburb. Like, God, like, getting her period? Like, story is boring. Like, know that story. I don't need that story.
You're living,
like,
that story.
Yeah, like, that just didn't seem, it seemed like not worth my time. Hmm. Like, wait, they're confused and they have to go to a school dance. You know, like, that just didn't mean anything.
Teenage love, angst, whatever.
Yeah,
was not for you.
That didn't make sense. But somehow Anne Frank did, which just is. I mean, you know, like it's just what it is. But it was, and again, I think a lot of it had to do with my grandmother, and she was very, spoke a million languages and was very beautiful and was very stylish, and so like it also just sort of had this like, I could be somewhere else and I could do something else and I could be epic and things could be big, and so I feel like that morphed in some ways into the Somerset Maugham, Hemingway, like sort of big novels, big voices, you know, like, yeah. Loved all the Russian novels, like, oh, yeah. Man, like,
Anna Karenina.
Felt it all, yeah,
so
yeah.
So did they.
Yeah, no, so that sort of was, like, that was high school, that was, like, sort of the big, my big sort of, and I read a lot, I was, as I said, I would read, like, I would just get, like, kind of crazy OCD about authors and would just sort of hole up for a whole weekend and, like, read them and then just be like, oh, crap, there's also schoolwork to do. You know, like, sort of forgetting my schoolwork because I was like, well, I was reading, you know, Pride and Prejudice for the 47th time. So, you know, couldn't get to that. So,
yeah. Have you ever returned to Anne Frank since you've...
You know, I haven't. And it's funny, as an adult, I'm very... it doesn't really, like, I like, if, you know, like, it, like, the only, this is, like, a, no, I haven't, and I don't, it's not something that, like, necessarily I gravitate to.
Okay, I'll do that.
In
Thank
terms
you.
Of my own thinking or, you know, like, going there or anything like that. Like, I just, I don't know. It was, like, a real, but that's probably because it's just, like, it was this real phase of my humanity.
Yeah.
And so, like, she doesn't represent her or a time period, like, I fully imagine that people will listen to this and be like, that is the most offensive woman in the entire world. Like, Anne Frank is, like, this hugely important figure in all these other ways, but...
No, but I actually think the opposite will happen, because I think so many people connect with her and feel this sense of, like, it's so inappropriate that I would deign to... share anything with her.
Just want
stories,
your
so.
Listening public to understand that I am deeply inappropriate. I am totally.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, that is true.
In this
but,
sense, I don't think that's true.
But
largely,
you know,
yes.
I mean, I do think that. But it's also, I mean, it's the arrogance of being a reader, right? Like, how can we possibly think we can ever understand anybody else's thoughts or ideas or life? Like, that's myth number one. So, like, I understand Anne Frank. I think probably as much as anybody else does, and I have as much right to misunderstand what I read as much as I think everybody else does, because, you know, I mean, that's, I think we all are just misreading all the time, like, that's you know, like, that I didn't get what I should have gotten out of it the same way I didn't get what I should have gotten out of Laura Ingalls Wilder, like, or even out of, like, you know, silly Hemingway. Like, I just I missed it all the way across, but I got what I needed. So,
well,
you know.
I think that's the point, right?
Yeah.
That you have your version of Anne Frank, I have mine.
Right.
Justin Bieber maybe has his. I know he went to her house.
I don't yeah. Poor Justin Bieber. He's going through a hard time now.
It's tough times.
Peace to him, you know. Peace to him.
We're sending that out. That's so true. But I guess I'm thinking, so what brought you to Bryn Mawr?
What brought me to Bryn Mawr?
You're
so
already in Pennsylvania.
I was in Pennsylvania, yes. So my parents set a rule. My parents are very practical people, and they were just like, if you're unhappy, if you want to come home, if we have to drive you somewhere, like, we're not interested in going anywhere where we can't drop you off, go to lunch, and then come back in the same day. Like, which... Some listening to this might think that that's not good parenting, but I did live in Pennsylvania, so it was kind of like you could go to any kind of, you can go to urban school, you can go to a rural school, you can pick the school you want to go to, but if we, you cannot have that be like a 9 million hour drive, because I'm not wasting my whole day, and there better be some place to go to lunch while we drop you off. Like, so it was very, like, they were practical people. They were like, you can do whatever you want, but here's, like, a radius of things. And there were, like, no airplane, because, like, that's... Do you know how much your college is going to cost anyhow? Like, what... You're crazy. Like, so that was the guidelines. I mean, they were just like, you know, if you want to go to a place where you have to fly, I hope you can also walk there, because, like, we're not paying for even one ticket. Like, they were just... It was, like, a super... It wasn't even, like, an angry conversation. It was just, like, here are the... Here are the parameters of this amazing journey you're about to take. It better have, like, we're not wasting our whole lives. And it's interesting, because I think they were, if I wonder sometimes, as I've lived in different places, if they would have been, like, if that would have been a different conversation, if it had been in a place where it would have been, like, a 6 hour drive to get to one kind of school, you know, like, that wasn't so accessible. But it was true that we lived within, like, 5 hours of every kind of school that the United States has to offer. And I wasn't, like, a good enough student that I was like, Harvard or Yale, what would it be, you know?
What kind of student were you?
I was a good student. I was, you know, I was a late bloomer. So I was not a good student my my freshman and sophomore year, and then, I mean, this is like nerd stories everywhere. I had a teacher in my sophomore year, and he actually took me aside and was like, you know, you don't have to be the way that you think you have to be. You could be a different way, and you could read books, and you could be really smart, and you don't have to. I was like one of those people who was like, what are the popular kids doing? I will do that. Like, so they were all in like chorus. So I have a terrible voice and hate singing. I love to sing for myself, but not like in a group scenario. But, and then like, I was like, you know, field hockey player, like just did a whole bunch of things that were just like really not, you know, again, as I've already noted, I hate being outside.
I was gonna say, field hockey is outside.
Dislike sweating also. Like, wow. I just don't like any of it. So, but, He said, I'm going to let you go into, you don't have the grades for it, but I'm going to put you into AP US History. And you should just really think this summer about, like, who you want to be and not how you could be like everybody else.
Wow.
Don't you imagine high school teachers have that conversation 10 million times a day? Like,
they should,
that's,
I hope.
I think that's all they must do.
Yeah.
But... And maybe I am actually the only one who ever listened, but I actually did. So I took my U.S. American history class with Bonnie Brill, and I want her name out there in the cosmos.
Bonnie Brill.
Bonnie Brill, the best history teacher in the entire world. And I just like, well, and this is, if we were talking about important books, one of our foundational texts that we read through the whole semester was Howard Zinn's History. Yes, exactly. And I became obsessed with Howard Zinn, and I became obsessed with that version of things, and that you could like use knowledge to fight against injustice. Like, all of a sudden I was like, oh, I don't have to stockpile food and just take care of my brother. I could actually be a person who, like, I could actually
leave the attic. And...
Yeah, like that all of those stories, which had felt unrelated, actually are completely related and are a part of this much longer history. And I loved that class, and I did really well in it, and I sort of like found my voice. Like, I just was like, oh, like, I don't have to be quiet. Like, I can say things and have arguments and take positions. And actually, it was very funny because I was very liberal, and I was very good friends with him, Kenny Davis, shout out to Ken Davis, was very conservative, and so he and I would literally like sit there and have these like crazy fights about state rights versus federal, like, you know, about, you know, stuff happening in like Reconstruction, and everyone else in the class would just be like, why do you let those nerds talk? But Bonnie Brill was like, go nerds, talk. And it was amazing. And so I was an okay student, and I was an okay student, and then I became a very good student, because all of a sudden I just became really activated across the board, and I was just like, couldn't read enough and couldn't write enough and loved school and like just really got into it. I wanted to go to either Haverford or Swarthmore. I definitely didn't want to go to Bryn Mawr, because I was like, I had some female friends in high school, but I was just like, women's college, what would that be like? Like, that sounds like a horror show. But my college advisor was like, why don't you do this? Why don't you go to Bryn Mawr in the morning, like, get your anxiety out, like, do an interview at a place you don't want to go, like, you know, just to get loose.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like... And I walked on the campus, and my tour guide was a woman from India who had absolutely the most beautiful British accent. And she was also like, I mean, in retrospect, I just feel like and then she was talking about having just come back from Paris, where her roommate, lived, and you know, so they were best friends, and so, you know, and so it was like this, and then the campus itself was like the most beautiful place I'd ever seen, and all of the women running around were like super posh and amazing. I do feel like I should go on record as saying I never met one person. My best friend from college was from Silver Spring, Maryland. My other best friend was from Manchester, New Hampshire. My life partner is from Boise, Idaho, which is as exotic or foreign or, you know, like, That the Bryn Mawr that I thought I was signing up for had nothing to do with the actual group of women. Yes, yeah, who were all from, you know, like mostly from the East Coast, and but we're all actually just so different, and also committed to books, and also committed to ideas, and we're also interested in staying up late and talking about like states versus federal, you know,
yeah,
just nerd things like that. That, and so it was great. It was like, a really happy 4 years.
Hmm.
Although I have to say, I don't think I read, when I was thinking about, like, talking about, like, my journey, all my stories were, like, early, and, well, because I fell in love with art history in college.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, this art history block of time where I, like, literally don't think I've read maybe a novel the whole time. Like, I just was, like, so history, art history. And then I was thinking, it was in graduate school where I was like, maybe I should start reading novels again. Like, maybe.
But wait, well, what if you're like reading paintings? Don't you like, you're reading paintings? Like, doesn't that count in some ways? Or is that just like a meaningless metaphor?
Yeah, I don't really like to read paintings. Like, I don't like that because it suggests that to look at a painting isn't enough, but to read, like, it privileges literature. Oh, okay. And writing and reading, and I think to really be an art historian, you have to, I think you have to value words and literature and all of that, because you obviously produce a lot of that, but you also have to acknowledge that if you really wanted to just study all of that, then you should go into a literature department. Like, if you want to commit to visual objects, then you have to hand off that some things can't be, like, that you're always working in translation.
Hmm.
And that translation is always imprecise. But I don't like to think that that's what I do, and I don't like to think that I, like, that that's what I encourage my students to do. Hmm. I try to encourage them to a little bit more, like, first of all, give more power to the painting, like, or the sculpture, like it's trying to tell you something, and it's your job to, like, listen, even though that's also, like, another sort of, like, but it's your job. Yeah. To sort of feel it and be open to it and allow yourself to see what's there instead of what you want to see or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know,
so, like, you think, like, consciously or not, that's why you weren't reading novels at that time, or is it just like grad school is really crazy and there's no time?
You know, I think college was so active. I was in a less, reading for me is there's a dreaminess that I associate with it. Like, there's a way, it is about moving away from myself in a happy way, in a good way, and sort of like and I think that when I was in college, I really wanted to, I was feeling, to use the words of Nicki Minaj and Beyonce, I was feeling myself, like, and I was feeling like, I don't need anybody else's version of that, or anybody, like, I don't need any other dialogues. I got, like, me and my team have the dialogues going on, and, like, that's what I was, you know. And then I think that like, everything, like, that felt really big and powerful, but that I did start to, like, you know, I mean, reading's like a, it's like you're like, it's like a longing. Like, I just was like, there's something, there is that dreaminess that I am missing that I want back. And I want to be the person who is in a book and in a place, and that, like, I don't really want it to end, but then I'm racing through it to get to the end, and then I'm just gonna sit in a room and just sort of, like, stare at a wall for an hour, just feeling that feeling. And I think that I was also just, by the time, so I only really found art history, I took my first art history class my junior year of college, and then I became, like, obsessed. Like, I took, like, all art history classes. Like, I just became a crazy person, and I had a lot of catching up to do if I wanted to go to graduate school, like, because I was a history major. And if Bryn Mawr hadn't had such a good art history program, I would have never gotten into graduate school, because everybody else would have been like, so this chick has, like, six classes, and she thinks that, you know, like, other people were, like, majors and stuff. But I think that when I got into graduate school, I started reading more I started came back to novels, but also some of that was coming back to coming into also studying more contemporary art, because Bryn Mawr at that time, although it's different now, they really didn't have a contemporary art historian. So I only started really thinking about contemporary art seriously when I went to graduate school, and then when I also started working in museums. And that a little bit also brought me back into thinking about art more holistically, like that there aren't actually these super, like, theater is over here, and, like, visual arts are over here, and, like, novels are over here, like, you know, authors are over here, like, that those are all people who are moving around and talking to each other in different kinds of ways, and that, so, like, it didn't, no longer made sense to just be so, like, and I also felt less sort of like I needed to catch up, like, I sort of got to graduate school and had sort of, like, the first year where it, like, just took me, like, a little bit of, like, you know, like, oh crap, I actually don't, never took a Renaissance architecture class, like, that's like a hole that is big. And then just by the second year, though, like, every, I just realized, like, oh, everybody is struggling, you know, like, the people who are super Renaissance architecture people are dying in their, like, American art class, or what, you know, like, that we all sort of had that, so it was, it was better, but yeah. And also, I started doing internships, and I would spend lots of time on the train and the subway, which is also, like, yeah, like, there was no phones then. I'm like, talking like I'm 100,000 years old, but, like, you just, like, I always had a book, or I had, like, the New Yorker, where I, and I would, like, make my lists of the books that I needed to read, so, yeah.
Are you a big magazine reader?
I read the New Yorker pretty religiously. Used to be, like, a cover-to-cover kind of person. Like, again, I like to, you know, I like to be really thorough, but not anymore, because life is short, and sometimes their articles are just not, you know, like, I'm starting to get to an age where I'm like, I just, that's like a hole in my knowledge that I'm like, I'm okay with it, you know, like, I know I should know more about, like, gene splicing, but, like, I'm just gonna leave that to the experts. I can't with everything, you know?
Yeah, fair.
I mean, I can't keep up with Taylor Swift and know about gene splicing, you know, and I've made my choices. I'm good with them.
I think you made some solid choices.
I feel like I did, you know? Yeah.
So what are you reading these days?
Well, I am pretty promiscuous with what I read. Like, so right now I'm actually, when summer first got, I read, like, through a million super craptastic novels. Like, I don't even remember what the names of any. Actually, I was telling somebody to read a book that I thought they would enjoy, and I could not remember the title of it at all. And, like, Mickey was like, this is the title of it? You know, and, but it was gorging, because it was, like, school was out, and that is usually the first thing. May 15th, I go to the library, and I just, like, oh, I read the new Curtis Sittfeld book. That's the takeoff on Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yeah.
But I love me some Curtis Sittfeld, so that was awesome. Yeah. That was, like, a big, like, I was very excited to get to
was
that.
Was that good?
No. no. I mean, actually, that's not true. She picked a difficult, I think it's difficult to do, I don't really understand the vogue for redoing books, and that's a big thing now. But
there's a lot of Austin too.
Yeah,
I mean, it seems to be in that genre.
And you realize how it's difficult to work within. I actually sort of imagine that it must be a very interesting exercise, because it's somebody else's plot. Like, and she, so at the end, I will say that I was happy I read it. I was reminded of how I just think she is absolutely clever and smart and really attentive to class in ways that I love. Like, I think Prep is great, and American Wife might be her book. That's, like, sort of the secret book about Laura Bush. I loved that book. I thought that was really, really smart. She writes women amazingly well, and she's not. And I say that as in that she's deeply sympathetic and deeply vicious about women, which I think is, like, that's, like, the highest compliment. That, you know, like, that. They are whole characters in their, you know, beauty and ugliness at all times. And so the end actually started to feel more like her book, but the beginning feels very like, this is a writing exercise about doing something that, you know, but by the end I felt like, oh, I've given up a little bit thinking about Pride and Prejudice, and I'm just now in her world of characters. But I have the new book. I'm of course blanking on the name, but it's about the two sisters from Ghana, and one of them, I haven't started it yet, one of them stays in Ghana, and one of them is put on a slave ship and comes to the United States, and it's about their sort of two stories of their, and I'm excited to read that. That just feels like the kind of book I have had the Luminaries on my desk, and I cannot read it, and I don't know why. Like, it's like one of those books where it's just like, it just is staring at me. I have the Ferrante book, which also I have now checked out from the library 3 times, and I just need to sit down, and I always say this, I have to give myself an hour with a book, and like, because it's, I'm resistant to starting it, like that's like a little like
the contrarian in you.
I don't want to give in, like I don't, like I have other things to do, and you know, like, and then because then usually, I mean, I binge, so like then I'll just be like, well, I'm not going to respond to any of my emails for 3 days or eat, because I'm just going to sit and read this book and reluctantly talk to human beings if forced to. So I mean, I'm excited to read the Ferrante books because everybody's,
is that
so,
how you find books that you teach? Because I know when we first spoke about having this conversation, you mentioned Station 11 and that you had just taught Station 11.
Yeah So that is, and I have increasingly tried to teach, move more novels into my classroom, because I think I feel like it's good for all of us. I feel like the students, so Station 11 was interesting, because Station 11, I literally just like wrangled it into like a syllabus wherein it made probably no sense at all. Like,
what was the class about?
The class was a WGSS senior seminar, and the topic was women art activism. And we did a chunk at the end about science fiction and apocalyptic literature. So we did sort of Octavia Butler, and so it was a crowbar to fit it in that I think that it would have made a lot more sense to cover other things that we didn't cover. But I have to say, I wanted to teach it for just totally selfish reasons, because that book was hugely meaningful to me. And it kind of hit me out of nowhere. Like, I just read a lot of good reviews about it, and it seemed like the kind of book I'd want to read. Actually, it's funny, I was in my, it was over the Christmas holiday, and I was at my in-law's house. And I felt really guilty because I could not put the book down. And then, and I won't give anything away, but there's a particular moment at the end of the book. I mean, I just literally was like, I was actually on a plane, and I was just hysterically crying. But like this kind of crying, actually, I've had that reaction to reading Franzen's Freedom. Like, just like sort of this overwhelming sense of like the beauty and grace of humanity, like, that gets me, like, and that to me feels like I'll read a million bad books to have a moment like that, where it's just like this overwhelming sense that
what was the moment? This book has been out for long enough,
all right,
I think,
spoiler alert. It's a moment where you think one of the characters is about to be killed, and another one of her friends is with her, and it was a friend that had made a mistake and had gotten them captured. It's like this post-apocalyptic world, and they've been captured by this like team of evil baddies who are just doing evil bad stuff, and she looks up, and so it's an interior dialogue, and she looks up at her friend, and she says, she's saying to herself, like, I wish I could tell you that you were a good friend to me, and that I'm not going to get the wording correct, but you were a good friend to me, and we saw many beautiful things together, and I'm okay. And I just thought, like, God, that's all there is, right? Like, that's all there is. And it's funny, I'm getting like a little like, even in my very bad remembering about what happened, but when I taught it, I remember pulling them to that moment in the class. And I remember, I mean, and I will say this, like, it was one of the, it was like a magical class. Everyone in the class was amazing. They were great, great. All of them were brilliant, interesting individuals. All of them were radically different in terms of their own scholarship and interests. And it was like one of those magical teaching moments, like, where you just have this room full of people who are, like, open and, like, ready to have this, like, just ready to have a real conversation. And we were talking about that moment, and I got a little, I'm not going to say teary-eyed. I'm not really, like, a, making it sound like just walk around sobbing all the time. But I was just sort of like, I want you guys to, like, puzzle this. And then a couple of them got very teary-eyed. And then a couple of the other people in the class were like, so, like, we kind of had this, like, super intense, or maybe I just had that moment. Like, you know, because it's then, like, I mean, yeah. I didn't really want to interrupt it by being like, is it just me? Or, like,
you want to break the spell?
Are we all crying? What's happening here? You know, like, we're talking about sci-fi and feminism. Like, but it felt just so, and it was interesting because the whole time the class had been really resistant to the idea of art ever really mattering. It's a lot of sociology students and a lot of just students who were like, activism is for real and art and literature is like, it's like a game that you play on the way to like actually doing something. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't my job in that room to be like, you're all totally fucking wrong. Like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And FYI, that's completely offensive to my soul. But, you know, because, like, that is, like, a legit, you know, like, it's a legit, you know, political and intellectual position. But it was really interesting because I felt like it was this turning point in which they all were like, oh, right, like, I'm a person. And I have actually also heard a piece of music or read something. Like, even if that moment didn't mean anything to them, they were like, oh, like, in my other life where I'm not...
Like, it gave them access
this person,
to something.
Like, you know, like, this person with totally legit reasons to say, like, the world is completely screwed up and we can't, like, you know, making a mural is not enough. Like, you have to do something. You have to feed somebody. You have to, like, activate, you know, like, that yeah. there's real injustices. But that in their own, like, that it was this really sort of great moment of being, like, we all know all of that language. But is there any way to sometimes have this happen? Like, and what does it mean that this happened with this book that, you know, isn't exact, I mean, like, you know, isn't what I think probably anybody would call, like, highly, you know, like, it's a book that came out that will probably in, like, 10 years, like, be totally obscure. Like, it's just, but it was just lovely, and it was lovely to teach it, and I was so happy to read it again, and yeah, it was totally, I mean, Sheila Hetty's book is another book that I teach in almost all my classes. I'm blanking. How Should a Person Be? That's another book that, I mean, I think that book is a little more, that book is interesting, and I think will probably have, like, a longer life in terms of sort of, like, a public and intellectual consciousness, just because I think Hetty is a different kind of author, but... that's another book that I love to teach, just because I also just love to sort of be like, let's, like, I had to fight with this, now you fight with this. Mm-hmm. Like, let us, like, let's join together and figure out what's going on here. And that book also, like Station 11, like, really provokes you to be like, if you don't think this matters, then tell me what does. Like, mm-hmm. And if you can't, then you need to, like, you know, like, if it pushes you to really say, like, that it's one thing to sort of posture about, like, everybody's horrible, yeah. The world is terrible, nothing is real, like, you know, art is bullshit, like, you know, whatever. But that book is very, both of those books are interesting because they're like, well, what else is, like,
yeah.
What's your other option here, you know? And where does that other option, what different does that actually produce? Which I think is also a really, like, important question. Like, if this isn't working, you know, if you don't want to believe in beauty or salvation or some kind of ability for us to just stop and say, like, you know, I see you and it's okay, like, then what else, like, what's the other,
why are we here?
Yeah, like, yeah. What's the other thing? What, because I'm ready, like, to sign up for it, I just don't know what it is. So
is it scary, like, as a teacher to kind of make yourself vulnerable with the students and give them a book that has made you like go through something with the expectation that they may not meet you there? Like they may not have a response, never mind your response.
No, no. I mean, I feel, and that's, you know, I mean, I think that being an art historian, like my first class taught me out of that. Like, you know, you're standing in front of some of the most, you know, beautiful, important, you know, like, it's amazing that any piece of art is still around, quite frankly. You know, like, you're looking at things that are incredibly old and incredibly fragile, and that, you know, just even thinking about the effort and time and humanity and sacrifice it takes to have even just one thing make it, like, 100 years, never mind, like, thousands of years. Like, it's kind of unbelievable. Like, it's just mind-boggling. Like, working on this artist right now, and she did, like, 800 paintings in her lifetime, and we can maybe find, like, 200 of them, and she only died in 1940. So I'm like, if that's the typical, like, how much is gone is, like, unbelievable, but then how much remains is actually even, like, it's just, it's exceptional. But, you know, like, in the very first class, you've got kids sleeping in the front, you know, like, they're just like, pyramids, whatevs, you know, like, and I think, and I think that that's on me, though. Like, that's my job to, and not like, oh, if I'm good enough, or like, oh, I'm a missionary, or anything like that, but like, I don't really blame them ever for not, there's so much cultural, we are compelled as a country to keep saying it doesn't matter, we don't care, like, to sort of just, to never be earnest, to never be locatable. And I'm the worst. I'm completely sarcastic all the time. And as my teaching style, I never, and this has driven many people are always very angry about this. Like, I never give it up. Like, so they don't know what I think. Like, so I'll be like, okay, blah, 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 blah. And then I'll just totally, and I'll get people like totally like swirling, like that's the way. And then I'll love to like clobber them with like, or, you know, boom. Because I don't really feel like it's my job to, it's my job to make, my job as a professor to make you sort of think about your options. But I don't really maybe, as long as you legitimately think about your options and then choose one, then I don't have hurt feelings about, like, I think that there's all kinds of people who are like, you know what, I have enough shit on my plate and I cannot care about that painting. Like, and I cannot care about you wanting me to go to a museum, and I cannot care about you wanting me to care about that, because that's one thing I actually can't handle right now. I respect that. Like, you know, like, there were many times in my life, and especially in college, where I was like, I have this amazing party to go to where I'm going to get, like, drunk as all fuck and make out with somebody. And so, like, you can keep talking, professor, but I, like, am not even here. And, you know, like, that's cool. We're all on our journey, you know? And so I think, I don't really take it personally. I mean, sometimes I feel sad because I feel like it makes me sad to imagine being that well defended that young. Like if you can't be open. And I just sort of then tell myself, like, well, they're probably open to something else. Like, they love to, like, take walks in the woods. Or, like, there's a million places that you can get all of this in life. Like, but sometimes it makes me feel sad because I just think, like, you know what? Like, life can be very long. And if you don't have anything that gives you, like, secret happy, like, if you're just walking through being bored all the time, like, that to me is like purgatory. Like, I just can't.
Or worse.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, so that sometimes I feel like, you know, you would do better to be a little more open, or, but some of it's, you know, like, people just are on their journeys, you know.
That's all we can say.
Yeah. Now.
Well, I want to say thank you for doing this.
I want to say thank you for asking me. This was awesome. And I apologize to my family and all my friends who I've already insulted.
Memory of Anne Frank.
Oh, God. Justin Bieber. No, to my Jewish relatives, to all of it. To Justin Bieber, to Drake. I brought him into this.
Nicki Minaj, you brought her into this?
No. I brought her in a good way. Drake too. They should be happy with.
I think you should apologize to Ruth, the palm reader, because if she's still with us, I don't know if she's still alive.
I want to see what her palm has to say.
Wow.
Yeah. Elizabeth Dark. Bishop. That's the person
I was thinking. Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. Totally yeah. amazing.
Yeah. Sad, but amazing. Yeah. yeah, thank you. This was super duper fun.
Super fun.
I'd like to thank our guest, Alexis, for sharing her story with us. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. We are dedicated to sharing the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. On our website, you can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode. You can follow us at ChaptersPod on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Mary Mahoney, and you can follow me at MaryMahoney123. I'd like to thank our technical director, Taylor, who engineered and produced this episode and also wrote our theme music. She can be found on Twitter at MJTThePhD. Thanks for listening to Chapters.